The following program has been brought to you by Cain Vineyard and Winery. Cain Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cain5.com.
Hi, this is Bernie Wides on the air again with the Naturalist Show. And if you've been a listener, you know we had two shows on chickens, which were pretty funny. And we had a lot of chicken jokes. But today we're going to a completely different topic. And my guest today is Dr. Judith Weiss, who teaches at Rutgers. And we'll talk a little bit. Judy, say hi to everybody.
Hi, everybody.
And Judy, tell me just, I'm always interested about people's backgrounds. How did you get into the fish business?
Well, I wouldn't say I was in the fish business exactly. I'm in the marine biology business.
Okay.
I was always interested in biology. I had a summer as a child in Shelter Island and was particularly fascinated by the beach critters that I would run into. And pursued science, and as I was getting older, it was clear it was biology was the science I really liked, and it turned out that it was ecology and marine ecology in particular.
Right,
and I've been doing it.
How long? You don't have to say. Okay.
Longer than I care to say.
It doesn't go back to the Pleistocene, so it's okay.
Not only
okay.
Devonian.
Devonian, right. Okay, yeah. So that's good. And are things different today for women who want to go into science than when you were
yes,
younger?
Oh, yes, and I would like to take a little credit for that. I've
okay,
been very
good.
Involved in women in science issues, and actually at Rutgers now I'm a co-coordinator of an advanced grant that we, advanced is the name of the grant, type of grant from the National Science Foundation for women in science. So yes, things are much better, and I could tell improvements in the 1980s when I would go to a conference and there would be a break and there was then a line at the ladies' room, which had never been there before.
Right. So. Okay, so we really made progress. And
yes.
Women in the science field.
Particularly in biology, there's still relatively few women in physics and engineering. There's still a long way to go there. But in biology, it's pretty much 50-50 now.
That's good. And you just showed me an article that you have in Bioscience magazine, and your three graduate students are women.
Yes.
So that's very nice to see.
The past decade, most of my graduate students were women. At the beginning, most of my graduate students were men and occasional women, and in the last decade, it's mostly women and the occasional man.
That's terrific. Okay, so let's get down to the topic today. Judith has a new book out called Do Fishes Sleep? And it's part of the Nature series, right, that was done for Rutgers?
Question and answer.
Question and answer format. It's a terrific format for the whole family, for kids and adults and everybody. If you have no background in the field, it's great. If you have a background in the field, it's good too, because Judith goes into details and significant facts and information. So I looked it over last night and I really enjoyed reading it. In fact, I got so interested in it that I forgot to write down questions for today. But I did.
Well, they're all written in the
book. They're all written in the book. That's true.
Whatever you want.
Right. So let's start out with the title of the book, Do Fishes Sleep? Tell us about that, Judy.
Well, it's not named that because that's the most important question we deal with. It was just the series likes to have a question in the title.
A catchy question.
Right. So I originally thought about do fish smell, and the editor thought that might be a little off-putting. So I came up with do fish sleep, something that people may wonder about. Because fish don't have eyelids, so they can't close their eyes. But yes, they do sleep.
They sleep with their eyes open.
Right.
Okay. That takes a good trick. I never tried that. Well, I don't know if we could do it.
I don't think animals with eyelids can do it. No. But if you don't have eyelids, you don't have much choice.
You have to sleep. So you see them very still in the water.
Right. People that have home aquariums will see their fish, you know, often down at the bottom. If they turn the lights on in the middle of the night, the fish are sitting there pretty still on the bottom.
Okay. So let's start at a basic question. What is a fish?
Okay, a fish is a vertebrate, meaning it's got a backbone. Okay, so it's good. In the same large group with amphibians and reptiles and birds and mammals. But there are actually more fishes. If you look at the number of species, there are more fishes than there are amphibians, reptiles, birds, and mammals all put together.
Right.
So fish comprise over half of all the vertebrate animals. So number one, it needs to have a backbone, spinal column. It's generally aquatic and uses gills, and they usually have scales. Okay. So there are certain things out there that are called fish, like a starfish or a jellyfish, that aren't really fish.
They're not fin fish.
They're not really fish.
Okay.
So they're not covered in this book. The book covers things with the vertebral, true fishes, vertebral column, fins,
scales. Yeah, even so, some fish have microscopic scales. You can't see them.
Right, but they're there.
But
anyway.
They're there as a protection.
And there are different kinds of scales that different kind of fish have.
Right. I know the ancient fish, the gar, has very thick, tough scales.
Right. Those are called ganoid scales. They're very thick, and they're kind of fit together like a mosaic tiles.
Armor plating almost.
Right.
Yeah.
And then there are the sharks, the cartilaginous fish that are sharks, have kinds of scales called placoid scales that are kind of structurally like very small teeth with the outer enamel and inner
like dentition.
And they're all very tiny, but they make the skin feel like sandpaper because they stick out a little bit.
They used to use that years ago as sandpaper.
Yeah.
Shark skin.
Okay. Well,
I remember that. Yep. And it was a good sandpaper.
And then the most abundant fishes, the so-called modern-day fishes or teleost fishes, generally have scales that are, they're called cycloid scales. And they are overlapping, and they sit in pockets in the skin, and they can come out, you can pull them out, or sometimes they just fall out.
Right.
And those scales are particularly useful if you want to know how old a fish is.
Yes, that's one way to age fishes,
you can count lines, growth lines, like rings on a tree.
Like rings on a tree. And what about, I think I remember you could, that little bone in the ear?
You can use the ear bone.
What's it called?
Otolith.
Otolith, right.
And that's probably more reliable, but just more difficult. You've got to get it sliced and count the rings. But it's actually better, more reliable, but more expensive and complicated.
Sure, but that's really like tree rings, because it's cylindrical, right?
Not necessarily. The otolith can be shaped.
Oh, I thought it was round most of the time because it has to move around or float around. And I think
some of them are weird shapes.
Okay, so that's good. So I think we've covered what is a fish.
Yeah, and how can you tell how old it is?
And how can you tell how old it is? Well, one other thing about the scales, I remember once seeing a herring fishery, and when they catch the herrings, the scales come off by themselves just about, and they use the scales to make things like sequins for dresses.
I've seen some hanging, what do you call them? The things that hang, chimes.
Chimes
made out of scales. I don't know what kind of fish it is.
Wasn't a herring.
Very large scales, like they're over an inch in diameter.
Yeah,
and
right.
You know the wind chimes.
They're dried and they make that tingling noise.
Yeah.
But the herring thing was interesting. These guys said, you know, they're almost as valuable as the herring itself because they use them for cosmetics.
I wonder if
you
want to
get they're still using it. If you want to get a sparkle, like in your hair or whatever. He says they're still using them. But, I mean, you know, the herring catch is way down these days anyhow.
Well, lots of fish are way down.
Okay, what about the sizes of fishes? I know there's some huge, huge fishes and some little teeny, teeny guys.
Right. Well, the teeny guys, there's some little minnow species that gets only to be about a half inch long max. And then the largest fish is the whale shark, which gets over 50 feet long. which is it's particularly interesting that such a large fish and a shark at that is a filter feeder. Mm. So these are you know, totally non-dangerous. I mean, I guess if it swam by and hit you with its tail, you could get knocked out. But these are not the kind of sharks that you need to be afraid of.
So
has this elaborate filtration device in its mouth, and it eats tiny plankton.
Yeah, so it's a filter feeder like some of the whales.
Exactly.
Except it doesn't have baleen. It has some kind of trap in it.
In the gills.
In the gills?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So it's strange that it has that name, whale shark, because it's not a whale. It's not a mammal.
It's not a whale.
It looks like a shark, but it doesn't have any teeth.
It is a shark, and I don't know if they call it whale just because it's so big.
I think so.
Maybe.
So it's a cartilaginous fish, is that right?
Cartilaginous, yeah.
Cartilaginous fish.
The bones are not made out of bone. They're made out of cartilage.
Which is a like bone, but it's not bone.
It's softer, right. More flexible. It's like what we have in our ears and our nose.
Is it called prismatic cartilage? Is that the right word? Have you heard that expression? No? Okay. I heard it about some critters. Okay, so we know there are generally two little groups of fishes, right? The bony fishes. And cartilaginous.
Well, we could separate them out various ways. It's kind of complicated.
Okay, well, the simplest
way. I think we should go there.
Okay.
I don't want to get into the detailed taxonomy.
Okay, yeah, and the museum, we have it on our big cladogram.
Right.
So they call them the rayfin fishes.
Right.
And how do you say cartilaginous?
Cartilaginous.
Cartilaginous. I have to accent on that. Okay, so... And what about fishes? They're pretty well distributed, pretty much, in water. But are they in all bodies of water, or what?
Well, they live in some surprising places. You've got some kind of fish that can live in hot springs where the temperature gets above 100 degrees. Mm. Called a desert pup fish, for example.
Right, right.
So it seems like a really hard place to live. There are fishes that will live... In very, very deep sea where the pressure is very high and it's totally dark. There are fishes that will live in the Arctic or Antarctic where the water is freezing cold year-round. Some fish live in caves
where it's totally dark. Are these the so-called blind fish? Or?
Right. The kind of what happens in evolution when population of fish move into a cave from different families. I mean, totally different, unrelated groups of fishes. Mm-hmm. But the fact of living in a cave, there is no premium in having vision. So if there are mutations to lose their eyes or reduce the size of the eyes, there's no disadvantage, as there would be for anything living where there's light. So the evolution over millions of years has caused many groups of fishes to become blind.
Right. Why bother making
eyes? It takes energy.
A lot of energy, sure.
To maintain a retina, for example, the cell turnover. So it's better to not have them and spend your energy in your sensory system for detecting water movement. Because that's a whole lot more important, having eyes. If it's totally dark, don't do you any good at all.
The eyes don't need it. So that old thing that people used to believe, use it or lose it, really doesn't hold true in evolution.
Well, it is sort of true. They didn't have any use for it, so that mutation is not a disadvantage. It's kind of an advantage to not put energy into making and using cell turnover and all in the retina.
Okay. So fishes are all over the place, right?
And there's also some that can live on land as long as they're damp.
Let's talk about some of those critters.
Yeah, there's a mud skipper.
Oh, they're cute.
In mangrove swamps, they're very cute.
Yeah.
And they sort of hop around. Their pectoral fins, that's the front fins, are pretty sturdy, and they can kind of walk around and hop around on the surface of the mud in mangrove swamps. They dig burrows. And they, as long as they stay damp, they can be out in the air. They're just as long as there's dampness, that's enough for them. And then there's a walking catfish that does the same thing.
It's in Africa, I think.
Right, but it's arrives one of these invasive species.
Oh yes, in Florida.
In Florida, and it can get around on land from one pond to another, so that helps it spread. Far and wide, and you know, as long as they're damp, they're fine. And then there's in Africa and Australia, there are fairly primitive group of fish called lungfishes, which can actually breathe through a lung. They live in temporary ponds.
Oh, ephemeral ponds.
When there's water in the ponds, they breathe with gills, just like every other fish. But the ponds seasonally will dry out. And as the pond is getting dried out, the fish will go into the mud and curl up, go into a kind of, they call it estivation. Mm. It's similar to hibernation. It's a dormant state. And they're breathing air during the dry season. They're sitting there estivating in the mud, curled up, and breathing through, you know, with their lung.
So the metabolism must slow down a great deal.
Yes.
So they don't need a great deal of air.
Right. Well, but
they're breathing very slowly.
Right.
Yeah. So I think in your book you said they leave a little hole up
they
through the
mud. They
leave a
hole so the air
will flow down.
Right.
And as soon as the rainy season comes,
then they burst out of this hole that they've made, and they swim around and behave like a fish again.
Right. Well, some frogs do similar things, I think.
I guess.
And if the pond dries up, they can cut down tremendously on their metabolism, and they don't need much respiration at all. But frogs can breathe through their skin.
Right.
Right. Now, some fish can do that, too.
Frogs have lungs, though.
They have lungs, right.
Typically, as amphibians, as adults, have lungs.
They have lungs.
So they're you know, this is not as unusual for an amphibian. That's expected of them.
To do it. Okay. So I think we can say that fishes are, wherever there's water, there are fishes, pretty much.
Well, they're, I'm not sure I would go that far.
Okay. Well, you could expect to have fishes wherever there's water.
Well, if it's too acidic or too alkaline, you know.
But there are some fishes in acidic waters and alkaline waters.
Right, but it can get, it can get too acidic or too alkaline. It could get
really polluted, and it could kill them.
Right. Yeah. So.
Okay. and what about? I know. How much time left, Jack? 2 minutes in the first segment. Okay. I know. Like the striped bass, can live in fresh water and in salt water.
Let's talk
about those fishes. They call anadromous. Is that right?
Anadromous or catadromous. There are. Fishes that will spend part of their life in fresh water and part of their life in salt water.
Mm-hmm.
So this involves extensive migrations. And ones that breed in fresh water and migrate down to the ocean and live in the ocean and then come back up the streams, back to fresh water, that's called anadromous.
Oh, yes. The other one are the eels.
And right. Oh, probably the most famous anadromous group of fishes are the salmons.
Okay.
And the salmon remarkably find their way back to the very, after living in the ocean for several years, find their way back to the very same stream that they were born in.
So how did they do it?
Quite remarkable. Through the sense of smell.
Okay, so they're imprinted
uniquely with a smell of home, but that they can find it from you know, hundreds of miles away is just,
it's amazing.
Hard to believe. Hard to imagine how they do it. And then the reverse is the eels, where they breed in the ocean, in a part of the ocean called the Sargasso Sea.
Mm.
Then they will migrate upstream into the freshwater and live most of their life up in freshwater, and then come down again to the Sargasso Sea.
That's called catadromous. How do you say?
Catadromous.
Catadromous. Right. Okay. And also the amazing thing is the European eels and the American eels go to the same place.
They breed in the same place, and then the little young larvae of the American eels, they go in the Gulf Stream.
Ah, okay.
And the American eels become mature, the larvae, a little sooner and peel off the Gulf Stream into the creeks, the stream, rivers of the U.S., While the European eel is not mature yet, it stays in the Gulf Stream, moves north in the Gulf Stream across east to Europe. Right. And by the time they've hit Europe, they are now mature and ready to peel off the right. current. And
that's terrific. That's another great story.
It's amazing.
It's amazing how
really
they do
cool.
that. Yeah. And if the Gulf Stream shifts and moves,
I guess it depends where it goes.
In trouble, right? Yeah. Okay, so folks, most people probably know about the Gulf Stream, which originates in the Gulf of Mexico and whips around Florida and then up the east coast of the United States. And the Sargasso Sea is somewhere northeast of Florida, isn't it?
Is
it?
Well, the Gulf Stream is part of a large cyclic current.
I mean, the Sargasso Sea is...
Yeah, the Sargasso Sea is sort of in the middle, and you've got this whole current system. The Gulf Stream is only one part of it.
Right.
That goes clockwise in the northern hemisphere. Mm-hmm. And Sargasso Sea can be viewed as sort of in the middle of mm-hmm. that. And the current system is a large clockwise gyre.
A gyre, right. So eventually it comes back down along the coast of Africa. Does it cut out around the Canary Islands? I think
it seems to swing back out. Goes down south and then it goes west again.
Right.
You know.
Yes, the early explorers learned about that, and that's how they use that with their sailing ships.
Okay.
I'll tell you a story after we come back from the break about Benjamin Franklin and his brother, who is the postmaster.
Okay.
So we're taking a short break. We'll be right back.
Following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune into The Food Scene Tuesdays at 3 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network. Hosted by Michael Harlan Turkel, photo editor of Edible Brooklyn and Edible Manhattan magazines, he'll further explore the amalgamation of food and art by talking to artists from a multitude of media. Guests will range from photographers, food stylists, interior architects for restaurants, industrial designers, all the players that make you want to eat with your eyes. Get ready to feast your ears every Tuesday at 3 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Hi, this is Bernie Wides back on the air with my terrific guest today, Judith Weiss, who's on the staff of Rutgers University, and she's a fish specialist, among other things. And her new book is called Do Fishes Sleep? And I love the cover with the lionfish on it. And we came across a lot of lionfishes in my trip to Belize, which I'll talk about later, because I think they're a problem now, aren't they, Judith?
A major problem.
Let's talk about them now, then, lionfish.
There are all sorts of organisms that get transported to new areas in the world. And many of them integrate well and do fine and don't make trouble. But in some cases, a minority of critters, because they have no natural enemies in the new place, may become extremely abundant and cause ecological or economic, in some cases, damage. And one such species is the lionfish, which is a very interesting, it's a very beautiful fish. It's native to the Indo-Pacific, and it has found its way probably through hobbyist aquariums or pet shops. They found it in the early 90s, after Hurricane Andrew. It may have been flooding of home right. aquariums or pet shops that had them. They ended up in the water. They ended up with enough of them that they reproduced and have, in the past 20 years, become extremely abundant throughout the southern Atlantic, the Caribbean, and so forth. And they have no natural enemies there. This is a beautiful fish. We'll hope to show a picture of it.
Sure.
It's very, it's got toxin, it's got spines, and it's got poison in the spines. So it's very good at repelling predators.
Yeah, it has good defenses.
Very good defenses. Mm. So it's become very abundant, and it's eating up lots of the native fishes there.
Especially the reef fish.
Yes, it lives right. with coral reefs, and it's eating up small members of all the beautiful fishes that you treasure on coral reefs. So it's making big trouble. And one thing that's going on with lionfish is in many of the Caribbean islands and in Florida, they are encouraging people to catch them and eat them.
Right.
They apparently are really tasty. And if you can get those spines, you know, catch it carefully so you don't get stung. And they're now getting, since this is a program, is a radio station with a lot of food
sure.
shows, there's cookbooks for cooking, different ways of cooking lionfish. They're having, you know, tournaments of who can catch the most. And so they're trying to deal with the fact that this fish doesn't have natural predators there to have people
we'll be
act
the predators.
As the natural as the predator.
Sure, we're the chief predators anyhow, so we might as well
might
get those
as
guys.
Well eat the lionfish.
Yes, but you know the trouble with the lionfish is I've never seen it in the fish market. I think they're afraid to handle it because they're so dangerous.
Well, you have to get those spines
off. You have to wear gloves when you handle
when
them.
When you catch them, and then you can just, you know, chop the spines off, and then you've got a perfectly fine fish.
You probably should skin them and get everything off.
Well, the poison is in the spines.
In the spines,
and if you just
right.
chop off the spines that are on the top, you know, sticking out of the fish, you got a perfectly safe fish to put in the market. So I'm hoping that the building up of a commercial, of making this a commercial species, it's not going to eliminate it.
No, but cut it down
enough. But it will reduce the population to some level that will not be doing so much damage.
Yeah, because, you know, one of my recent shows was on Belize, where we were out on an atoll, Turnip Atoll, and we were doing fish surveys on the reef, and we saw lionfish. And the guys running the program said, we just encourage people to kill them because they're populating, you know, like you say, they're eating up all those other little beautiful fish. And we dived one day amongst the mangrove roots, and they were there too because that's where the juvenile fish hang out that live on the reef, right? Most of the juveniles are born in the...
Well, a lot of them. I wouldn't say most of them, but we could talk about that another time. I have a former grad student studied mangrove. Fishes and mangroves.
Okay.
We can talk
That'll
about
be good.
This another
That'll
time.
Be a good topic because I love mangroves.
Okay.
I love that whole ecosystem. Mangroves, seagrasses, and the reef, they're all hooked together, right? Okay, so the lionfish, we'll put some pictures up at the end of the show and get a chance to look at it. Jack always puts them up and he says, click here if you want to see more pictures. So we'll have pictures about all the fish that we talk about and some other ones because Judy has a collection of fish photos. Like pinups, right, Judy? You have them in your room all over the place?
And
in your
lab? My office.
In your
office,
in the lab, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the lionfish, which is a beautiful fish. It really is. Okay, so how do fish prevent themselves from sinking?
Well, some fish will sink if they don't keep swimming. Fish like sharks have to keep swimming.
Keep moving all the time.
Themselves. But the teleosts, which are the most abundant bony fishes, the modern-day fishes, have a structure called the swim bladder above their digestive system. And this organ is an inflatable sac. Picture a balloon, if you will. And so they can adjust the amount of air in the swim bladder, and by inflating it more, they will rise up higher in the water.
Mm-hmm.
And by deflating it, they will sink lower. So they're able to keep adjusted to the depth that they want to be swimming at.
Okay, so where did they get the air from for this? They can come up and gulp it at the surface.
The initial inflation of the swim bladder is at the surface,
right,
for most fish. And there is a special organ associated with the swim bladder that can secrete gas from the bloodstream.
From the bloodstream.
Into the swim bladder, or absorb the gas back from the swim bladder back into the blood.
Okay, so when you say gas, it doesn't necessarily have to be oxygen.
Well, it's a mixture of things that can vary a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's not too different from air.
Mm-hmm. So fishes don't have to belch or give out air in other ways.
Well, they can actually. Yeah. Fishes can make sounds.
Right.
And a number of them make sounds by belching the air out
right.
the swim bladder.
Making bubbles.
Right. That's one of the swim bladder is a really good way for fish to make sounds. Because you picture like a drum. It's a hollow thing
right.
filled with air. So you can get noise out of it by hitting it,
mm-hmm.
and some fish have a little bony process that hits the swim bladder
like
to make noise. Others have the muscles around the swim bladder that vibrate, kind of like if you rub your hand on the surface of a drum, you can get a sound out of it. So the swim bladder is a really good way to make noise if you're a fish.
So there is a fish called the drum.
There's a fish called the drum.
And
there's
make
a fish
the drum
called,
noises.
And there's a fish called the grunt.
The grunt, that's right. There's a trout.
Named after
right.
their...
noise they make.
The noise they make.
And croakers.
And croaker, right.
Right,
exactly.
Right. Yes, when I used to do a lot of fishing, we would catch a sculpin, you know, like a sea robin,
mm-hmm.
and they grunted. They made noises.
Yeah, a lot of fish so make noises. Toadfish, another one.
Right.
And the noises are for communicating information.
Underwater.
Underwater. They can communicate, you know, fear, alarm,
mm-hmm.
by making a certain kind of noise. And they can communicate romance, you know, a courtship mm-hmm. kind of thing.
You think they sing songs, like love songs, like the whales
think so, but, you know, it's possible.
Right. We don't know. Now, there's more research to do.
You
know, you're not going to run out of research topics.
No.
For your graduate students, right? Okay. So, we just mentioned a whole bunch of fish, different kinds. The drum, the grouper, the grunt.
Croaker.
The croaker. And they all make noises that if you're a fisherman or fisher person, when you catch them, you can hear some of these noises. Because when you take them out of the water, they keep making the noises. Okay, so the next topic is, let's see, we spoke about how they prevent themselves from sinking, okay? And now this thing about fishes breathing in water, it's a very mysterious thing to a lot of people, because of course they all know that we can't breathe underwater. So can we talk about that a minute?
Okay, well, fishes, like everything that lives in the water, have structures called gills,
mm-hmm.
which we lack, which is the reason why we can't breathe in water.
Don't we have sort of a gill in the embryo state?
Well, not really.
We don't want to go into that.
No.
Okay.
But a gill is a way of bringing blood vessels very close to the surface, and then you pass water across the gills, and you have a way that the oxygen that's in the water moves from the water into the gills, and the waste carbon dioxide is a result of the metabolism of the fish that's higher in the blood than in the ocean or in the water that the mm-hmm. fish is swimming in, the carbon dioxide goes the other way. So you have gas exchange, which is what we have in our lungs.
Right.
But it's out close to the surface in the gills. And every aquatic animal has gills that it breathes with.
Some kind of gills to breathe that way.
Right.
So if there's a low oxygen in the water and dissolved in the seawater, then they have a problem.
If there's low dissolved oxygen, they have a problem. Some fish can do much better in low dissolved oxygen than other fish, but depending on how low the oxygen actually gets, fish are better off than many other animals in that a lot of them can just leave.
They can leave, right.
Go somewhere. If the oxygen gets very low, which happens as a result of excess nutrient pollution in the water and algal blooms and, you know, decay. I don't think I want to go into the whole thing
hypoxia,
here.
All that, yeah.
You know, the animals that are more mobile, like most fishes, can escape unless the area is too vast. And
it could be a very vast area, right?
And this dead zone happens in the Gulf of Mexico annually. That may be the size of the state of New Jersey.
Yeah.
So it's hard to get away.
So the fishes have a hard time. Unless they have an easy pass, they get on the turnpike and they're out of New Jersey.
But the fish have a hard time, but probably the critters living on the bottom have an even worse time.
Yeah.
Because they
can't
nowhere
leave.
To go.
Yeah. So one last thing about breathing, but they need oxygen.
Right? Oh, absolutely.
Like all living critters just about need oxygen.
Well, some bacteria.
Well, they're anaerobic, so.
Right.
But people always get confused with the oxygen, and they think it's the oxygen in the H2O. So let's clear that up.
Yeah, it's not the oxygen that's part of the molecule of water. It's the oxygen that is dissolved in the water.
Right.
That they are using.
Yeah, and the way you could think about that is if you drink soda that's carbonated, right, and it has bubbles in it, or you shake it up and it spritzes out, that's gas that's dissolved in the water.
Right.
It's not part of the water molecule.
Right.
So the oxygen is the same thing. It's not, as Judy said, it's not the H2O. It's dissolved oxygen in the water. So I always want to clear that up because people say, well, there's, you know, it's H2O. So, yeah, but they can't do that. Okay, so let's see. We spoke about breathing underwater. Yes, let's talk a little about fish reproduction. One of my favorite topics is reproduction. We always touch on that. So there are all these strategies and methods of reproduction, and how do the fish find each other, and how do they attract to each other? We said they make noises.
Some make noises,
and
others are living in schools, so they're all close together anyway. But some you will have special mating rituals, you know, certain males would get bright colors and fins, they flutter their fins a particular way. So there are various courtship type of methods. And the vast majority of fishes, once they're ready to mate, will have a kind of reproduction called spawning, which the females just drop the eggs, the male drops the sperm. The fertilization takes place in the water.
In the water.
The development of the embryos and the larvae is in the water. The parents have gone about their own business. And, you know, their whole process is just dropping the eggs and dropping the sperm, and then they go about the rest of their life.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're probably releasing many thousands or, in some cases, millions of eggs and sperm. And the vast majority of them are not going to make it.
Right, they're eaten by other critters.
Eaten by something. So, you know.
But that's why they have so many eggs.
Right.
Because there's no parental care.
Hardly any. Very few fishes have any at all. Okay. So that's the most common. And then there are certain kinds of fishes that have internal fertilization. The group of fish that some home aquarists are familiar with, guppies and platies and swordtails. They will have internal fertilization. The male fish has one fin modified for copulation called the gonopodium that transfers sperm into the female. Sharks also have a structure called claspers, transfers sperm. So most sharks also have internal fertilization and development of embryo inside the female. And then there's the, you know, some exceptions and really strange things where, for example, in the seahorses and pipefish, the male has a pouch, the female deposits the eggs in the pouch, and it's the male who gets, quote, pregnant.
And gives birth.
And gives birth right. to the baby.
And so the pipefish is the same, right?
Pipefish and seahorse are
the same family.
Yeah. So all the ones in that family have the male with the pouch.
Right.
And then there's, you know, a really bizarre thing one finds in some deep sea anglerfishes. Anglerfishes are recognizable by having a long, I don't know.
Like a fishing rod.
A fishing rod that, from their head
right.
that extends out and wiggles and attract. It's called angler because they're attracting other smaller fish, right. like a fisherman, like an angler.
Some of them and look like worms.
Yeah, it can look like a worm. It can
or a light.
Right. So it attracts them and they eat. So that's why they're called anglerfish. Anyway, there's a whole lot of different anglerfishes, but there are deep sea anglerfishes living in the dark deep sea where potential mates are few and far between, and so they have adapted a strategy where if a male and a female encounter each other, they become physically attached to each other. The male attaches himself to the body of the female.
He actually bites into her.
Bites in, mm-hmm. and then from that point on, he is functionally a parasite. He doesn't grow. He stays very tiny as a kind of a parasite attached to the female who grows bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And his role in life is when she's ready to lay eggs, he drops sperm.
Maybe. And the sperm are directly...
The location of the male angler
right
is
near, the,
near where the vent of the female is.
Right. So,
so he's
eggs,
dropping right. sperm in the right location.
Uh-huh. I know we have in our Hall of Ocean Life at the museum, we have the deep benthic diorama, and we have one. One of them is the wolf. Is it the wolffish also is an anglerfish? I don't know. No, it has that. It was needle teeth. But
a lot of deep sea yeah. fishes.
So anyhow, and the size difference is amazing, right? The male fish could be an inch at the most, a half inch, and the female could be 12 inches long.
Right.
Right?
Well,
so
all he's yeah. good for is depositing sperm, so
watch
you don't
that.
Need to
all he's good for. All right. Now it's coming out.
You don't need to have much else if that's your whole role in life, right?
Yeah. I know women love that. I always point it out to visitors. I say, read this about male parasitism, and,
right.
and they love it. They say, that's really convenient. That's terrific.
Right.
So... Yeah, the male just ends up as a sperm supplier,
exactly.
and that's it. There's no romance in this. There's no dating. There's
but
nothing.
There's no divorce either.
That's right. It's for life.
For life.
Once that male hooks onto the female,
right.
he practically gets absorbed by her body, right?
Well,
it's her blood supply.
And her nutrition.
Right.
Nutrition
All the nutrition comes from her.
So, but there's no divorce.
There's no divorce. That's true.
Yeah.
Hmm. But I don't know how, if we could recommend that really as a lifestyle. As a male, it sort of bothers me. But maybe as a female, you look at it as a...
No, I wouldn't care to have parasite. Anyway, so those are some you know, rather unusual reproductive things that one sees. There's also sex change that happens.
Yes, that's the next thing we have
in,
to talk about.
In some fishes where particular species, males can turn into females, or other species females can turn into males. So, for example, in the anemone fish, the clownfish, made famous in the Finding Nemo movie, those fishes, if a female is gone, the male will become female. So there's a biological mistake in the movie because the male fish in that movie, Marlin, goes to search for his missing Nemo, his
right.
baby. And in reality, Marlin would have turned into Marilyn.
Right.
But
his father would have become his mother.
Right.
But I can understand why Disney didn't do that.
Yes.
I think it was a Disney movie. Yeah.
I think so. It
could confuse a lot of little kids.
Right. So yeah. we'll have to pardon them for that.
Yes. So that's another thing we have in our Ocean Life exhibit that I point out to people, that the story of Nemo has been edited for the movies, let's put it that way, right, or rewritten. So that's pretty it's not that common in vertebrates.
It's not common in vertebrates. There's some lizards that will do it, and
uh-huh.
and again, it's not that common in fishes, but there's a number of species that will do it.
We'll do it, right.
And then other species that will do the other way, where... for example, in the wrasses, the blue-headed wrasse, which is fairly common in the Caribbean.
A reef fish.
Yeah. The ones with the blue heads are the males, and they live together with a bunch of females. And if that male is gone, gets eaten or something, the largest female will relatively
female.
Quickly change into a male.
Yeah, so she's already equipped with both organs. Male and female.
Don't think so.
So
I think her ovary becomes a testis.
Oh, I
her,
see.
You know, okay. the hormones start.
So they're not hermaphroditic.
Well, you could call it hermaphroditic in terms of time-wise changing
okay.
from one to the other, but it's not simultaneously right. hermaphroditic. Like, there's a fish called Rivulus, which is a marsh mangrove type.
Oh, okay.
Related to killifish kind of
okay.
thing.
Okay, mum and chaw kind of.
Well, it's in that killifish. Family.
Okay. Yeah.
And this is a fish that is simultaneously both a male and a female, fertilizes its own eggs.
Mm.
So it lives all alone. It doesn't need anything, any other partner at all
right.
to reproduce.
Sure, that's. I can see why in that environment it's probably hard to find a partner.
Well,
yeah. You know, it's dark and it's dreary.
And the mangroves. It's not anywhere near as dark and dreary as the deep sea bottom.
Deep sea. That's true. Okay, so we're going to have to stop in a minute. And we're going to have another show next week, also on fish. And we're going to deal a lot with fish as food and problems with fish as food and how to protect the food supply and conservation of this valuable resource. And all other things that pertain to fish in the sea. And I'm sure Judith has some other topics that we could talk about. But this is the end of the first show on fish. And I want to thank Judith for coming out all the way to Bushwick today and doing this show. And next week's show will be the return of Judith Weiss, and we'll do some more fish talk.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. This week, I came across a new website from the American Meat Institute and the American Meat Scientists Association. It's called www.meatmythcrushers.com. It purports to be addressing consumer concerns about additives such as sodium nitrates in your, ham and turkey roll and whatever, and animal welfare and food safety. I noticed as I went through the Meat Myth Crushers website, however, that it did not address anything like subtherapeutic antibiotic use in the meat chain. So I'm not sure how many myths they intend to crush. But, you know, as I always say, it's good to know what the opposition is thinking. And if you want to be fair about any issues around the food scene, it's wise to keep up with their press as well as ours. That's it for Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.
Did you know we have a show entirely about cheese? Take a listen.
Well, I know this is it's horrible to do visual things on the radio, but if you were all sitting in the studio, you would see this wheel from late May is quite pale in color. It's a little bit, like a milkier, sort of a very soft yellow. And then the wheel from late June is quite golden and intense looking. It's a really deep, deep yellow. What causes that difference?
Well, I'm quite sure it's the grass. It's the keratin in the grass. And, that's giving it that yellow color, not fat, but definitely coming from the pasture. Our animals are fed hay through the winter now. We don't use fermented feed because that won't work with our cheese.
Mm-hmm.
But so they're essentially grass-fed year-round with grain supplement.
If you like what you hear, Cutting the Curd airs every Monday at 4:30 p.m. on Heritage Radio Network. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast or check it out in our archives.